Welcome to the Savvy Shrink Podcast, brought to you by MHNRnetwork.com. I'm your host, Andrea Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and life coach. I will be sharing helpful information for individuals dealing with varying mental health challenges, ranging from trauma and loss to recovering from toxic relationships in love, work, and family, specifically as relates to narcissistic abuse recovery. Other poignant topics will include maternal mental health and special needs parenting, among others. The podcast welcomes guests who share their expertise in trauma-informed and evidence-based interventions, including the latest in neuropsychology. My ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse, is available at BookBaby and other digital online booksellers. I'm a believer in a strengths-focused perspective for my clients, which harnesses the power of internal wisdom and crafting the inner alchemy of healing. Please grab a cup of coffee or tea, and welcome to The Savvy Shrink. Hello, and welcome to The Savvy Shrink. Today, I'm going to be talking about my ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse. This is a book I published a few years back, and I'm working on some updates and some wonderful new clinical interventions that I'll be adding in. The current ebook is really a primer for survivors of narcissistic abuse, and I think it's a really good value ebook for people that are reeling in the aftermath of psychological abuse and really need kind of a starting point or compass roadmap to kind of guide them for next steps. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's in the book and sort of give an overview on what I find is helpful for my listeners and also my clients. In my book, I kind of give an overview of what narcissistic abuse is, and I give a little bit of a background on NPD, or narcissistic personality disorder. And then I move through and talk about the spectrum of narcissism, how people become narcissists, warning signs and ways that an individual could be dealing with a malignant narcissist in either love, work, or family. And then I move into some descriptions of vocabulary such as idealized, devalued, discard cycles, which I'm sure many of our listeners are very familiar with. Also terminology such as gaslighting, mind control, brainwashing, future faking, love bombing, Hoover maneuver, narcissistic supply, silent treatment, projection, blame shifting, trauma bond, you name it. So these are all vocabulary words and lingo that sort of follows with being a survivor of narcissistic abuse. And often in the aftermath, survivors are dealing with what we call cognitive dissonance, which I'll also go into detail and describe that. Further on in the book, I give some suggestions for how to move away from an abusive relationship with a narcissist, how to get help, and some beginning points of structure for healing and resources in the end of the book. So that being said, there's a lot to cover. I'm going to just give a brief conversation today because I wanted to bring attention to what's very common for survivors, which is cognitive dissonance. And that's the sense of confusion that happens in the aftermath of narcissistic abuse, where a person is trying to break away from the trauma bond and still has a sense of connection to their abuser. So they may still love that abuser, but at the same time, they know that person isn't healthy for them. So lowering the cognitive dissonance is something that I work with my clients once they're in no contact, to really help them to own their story, which is the truth. And once they narrate their story, have validation and confirmation for their story, which is the truth, then the cognitive dissonance lowers and it's easier for the client to really have more clarity and heal and break that trauma bond. As I said before, narcissism seems to be a huge buzzword in the media, and it's like the hot button phrase, I think, online. It's everywhere, in part due to our political climate, which could be the subject of another podcast. So I'm not even going to go there with that. But due to the political climate, actually, narcissism and NPD has actually come to the forefront. So that's one silver lining of all the chaos that's going on politically in the U.S., is that people now know what a narcissist is. Those of us who've been in the field for a long time have been wanting to educate everybody about the pitfalls of being in a relationship with a narcissist, whether it's in love, work, or family. And a lot of people ask me, well, how is it that you stumbled upon helping people with this particular subspecialty? It kind of seems a little odd. And it does, because, you know, the fact is that it really found me. I wasn't seeking it out at all. And in my private practice, and I've been in the field for over 20 years, I've worked with children and families. I work with women with reproductive mental health concerns, such as depression and anxiety during the childbearing years, and traumatic loss, grief and loss, perinatal loss, traumatic birth. So it came as a surprise to me that I ended up working with a lot of clients, and do work with a lot of clients, who are reeling in the aftermath of relationships and relational trauma. What happened is that I'm fortunate that I have healthy family and love relationships. I'm very fortunate that I have authentic, safe relationships in love and in family. Unfortunately, I did stumble upon my own experience of a soul vampire in a business setting, and this was many, many years ago. I'm not going to go into great detail just for confidentiality reasons and what I'm bound by ethics and legalities in terms of elaborating as a therapist, but the individual was in a business setting and I believe sought me out premeditatedly to try to extract narcissistic supplies. So the reality is that no one is immune from being targeted by a narcissist. And I think that's something that survivors need to be very aware of, because there's so much literature out there, also online, that is victim shaming and blaming. And the reality is that so many survivors of narcissistic abuse are very healthy, whole, intelligent, really wonderful people that have their act together and beautiful, smart, just have everything going for them, and actually have what Sandra Brown talks about in her books as super traits, which is basically high emotional IQ, empathy, compassion, reciprocity, integrity, authenticity, accountability, the capacity to empathize and compromise. These are all qualities, including honesty and respect, that are the foundational elements of a healthy relationship. And highly emotionally intelligent people have those qualities. So healthy people are drawn to highly emotionally intelligent people, and unhealthy people are drawn to it, like a moth to a flame. So in circumstances where someone is highly emotionally intelligent, it's really important that they have some sort of training in discerning what's healthy and what isn't. And it's not like we walk around on the planet expecting to bump into a narcissist, because they are very cunning, very manipulative, and those that are further on the spectrum of severity, such as a malignant narcissist or a psychopath, are really skilled actors that can pretend to have emotional IQ. A lot of them are very charming, very gregarious, and can seduce very well, whether it's in a business setting, a romantic setting, or even in a family relationship. It's almost like they all go to the same university for being personality disordered, to be perfectly honest. With that, going back to a strengths-focused, empowering perspective, many survivors feel that they are to blame and that there's something wrong with them, that there was something broken with them, that they were targeted by this pathological individual. And the reality is, no, they are not broken people. They had some sort of quality, and more than likely high emotional IQ. It's possible. And the clients I work with, the vast majority of clients that I work with are highly emotionally intelligent, very successful, intelligent people. And, you know, it's true that some people have a history of trauma. It's true that some clients may have narcissistic family systems. So when an individual encounters a narcissist in a love relationship, there's a familiarity there. So that is one subset of individuals who might be targeted because they feel that the connection with the narcissist is familiar to them. That sort of blueprint was laid, the foundation was laid in their childhood with the different dynamics in their family system. And I talked about this with Shahida Arabi in our podcast on the intersection of complex PTSD and relational trauma in adulthood. So that's something that you can also listen to on The Savvy Shrink. But I hear a lot of labeling of survivors as being codependent, and you know, I don't always agree with that. In fact, the vast majority of my clients, as I said before, are highly emotionally intelligent. The buzzword seems to be empath, although that's not a clinical term. It's really kind of like a super trait from the words of Sandra Brown. You know, it's sure, there are some survivors who might have some codependency features, but not all do. So to just label a survivor as being a codependent is victim shaming and blaming. That label doesn't help. And if it doesn't fit, then certainly it's not appropriate. If an individual has enabled an addiction, then maybe that term could apply, but it's much more complex. And it's also very, very disempowering. With a narcissist, there is a trauma bond, which can feel like an addiction. But in my experience and my clinical training, I don't tend to lean towards the addiction label. I don't feel that that's helpful. The trauma bond, however, can feel like an addiction because it's such a visceral connection. And that's also been discussed in prior podcasts I've had with life coaches, Kim Saeed, and also Shahida Arabi. And also Christine Louis de Cannonville, clinician in Ireland. So, you know, there's different perspectives and different takes on this, but the reality is, in my opinion, a survivor is trauma bonded with their abuser, not unlike the situation where some people have read about Stockholm syndrome. And as spoken about in prior podcasts and literature, when a survivor is in the idealization stage with a narcissist, whether it's in a business relationship, a love relationship, or even in a family relationship, the biochemistry is such that it's like such a high. So I suppose that's where the addiction component comes from. There's such a shot of dopamine that floods the body, and oxytocin and endorphins, when particularly in a romantic relationship, when a love object is targeted by a malignant narcissist, they will feel like they are on the highest pedestal ever. And if they've been whisked off their feet and elevated to the moon, eventually, unfortunately, what goes up must come down. And the devaluation stage is not too long around the corner, where the survivor will start to notice that the narcissist they're with is starting to devalue them. And that may come in the form of gaslighting, silent treatment, projection, blame shifting, overt verbal abuse, in some cases overt physical abuse. But I'm talking specifically about psychological abuse here. And it's so hidden, it's so covert, so insidious that most people don't know what's hit them until they've been in the relationship long enough, and suddenly they're blindsided by being discarded, and the cycles of idealized, devalued, discard ensue. So thus the cognitive dissonance. The client or the survivor is able to have the capacity to love deeply, and they're able to bond with their abuser. Unfortunately, in the circumstance of an extreme narcissist, their feelings run very shallow. They're not able to love in any true capacity. The depth of their connection is more of an attachment, where they can detach easily like a leech, but they don't bond like a normal, healthy person, and they can easily move on to another source of supply once they have drained the lifeblood of the current source of narcissistic supply. So it's really sad where that's concerned for the survivor, but the good news is that they've dodged a bullet, hopefully, and can move forward and heal in the aftermath. So I want to say a little bit more about cognitive dissonance, and I'm actually going to read an excerpt from my book. The target is rendered utterly confused when he or she is gaslighted chronically. And I think our listeners know what gaslighting is. There have been so many articles posted about it. The movie Gaslight was published in 1946. It's a black and white film featuring Candace Bergen, and it beautifully illustrates what gaslighting is. It's a form of psychological abuse that is imposed upon a target by a narcissist or a psychological abuser. So it's a manipulation tool that's designed to keep the target off kilter. The malignant narcissist feigns ignorance or retracts statements made previously to confuse the target and to impose a sense of unreality on the target so that he or she will begin to doubt his or her own reality and understanding of the situation. So, and also another example of gaslighting is from the movie Sleeping with the Enemy. Julia Roberts' husband is a prime example of basically a psychopath. He's an extreme malignant narcissist that's crossed over into psychopathy. And he marks his presence by straightening out the bath towels in the bathroom. And then Julia Roberts' character knows her tormentor is lurking somewhere in the house. And he wants her to believe that she's going crazy so that she'll doubt her reality. So with that, in the aftermath of narcissistic abuse, when a client or a survivor is moving forward with no contact from their abuser, the target experiences cognitive dissonance. And the survivor is rendered confused when he or she is gaslighted chronically. Basically, the survivor waffles back and forth between missing the seduction phase of the relationship, like the highs, and then spins back to the reality that he or she was emotionally abused in the most insidious, covert manner. A trauma bond was formed whereby the survivor has a difficult time breaking the bond with his or her abuser. With cognitive dissonance, there's a chronic state of confusion in which the target doubts his or her own logic and perception of the reality around them. The target holds two opposing thoughts at the same time, namely, I'm in love with this amazing person, and how could I be so in love with somebody who abuses me? The result is a dizzying sensation of spiraling into self-doubt and numbness. Basically, it means confusion of the worst kind. Cognitive dissonance is created by all of the abuse tactics that I mentioned above, including silent treatment, blame shifting, projection, but most especially gaslighting, and it reinforces the trauma bond. So the trauma bond is also called the betrayal bond, that was written about in a book by Patrick Carnes. As mentioned, the trauma bond refers to the powerful bond between the abuser and the abused, thus resulting in the profound difficulty for the survivor to leave the relationship. So being so bonded to the narcissist that it's almost psychologically impossible to leave because the target has been brainwashed or mind controlled in essence to believe that he or she cannot psychologically survive without the abuser. So the target simultaneously fears or hates his or her tormentor and loves the abuser, even though, she knows that the abuser is horrific. So these confusing states of mind create heightened anxiety, depression, self-doubt, profound energy depletion, and a literal emotional paralysis that renders the target shackled to the relationship. So one example that I wrote about is if any of you listeners watch Game of Thrones, oh my goodness, that series is an awesome series just for the acting in general, but to really understand the subtle nuances and the spectrum of narcissism all the way into psychopathy. Brilliant series. Incredibly graphic, very triggering. So it's not for the faint of heart, but I did write several articles for Psych Central about different characters and their manifestations of exposure to trauma and how that created the person that they were. And some of them are psychopaths, such as Ramsay Bolton. Others have severe complex PTSD, like Theon Greyjoy / Reek. Others have post-traumatic growth. For example, Sansa, or Daenerys, or Tyrion for that matter. So please feel free to read those articles on Psych Central under my blog of the same name, The Savvy Shrink. Also, I've written several articles for goodtherapy.org that are listed under my profile. Feel free to read them. There's a good number that are specific to narcissistic abuse. And many of those articles have been widely read on that particular platform. Also for the Minds Journal, I have a page filled with articles that I've written. And also for my own blog on my website, Andrea Schneider, LCSW, from Andrea's Couch. So moving forward, I wanted to share a little bit about next steps in healing once a client or a survivor decides to go no contact and heal. And that's what I do in my practice. And that information is also in my ebook, Soul Vampires. So again, I am creating a second edition, which will include more detailed clinical information and also some additional resources that have manifested in the last few years. There's new resources coming up all the time. So that's the good news, that we live in the day and age of modern technology. So information is widely distributed so much faster than it ever was. With that, though, survivors need to be discerning with the information they read. And there are some well-intentioned blogs that may actually be more harmful than helpful, especially if they're not written from a trained helping professional, somebody who is working with narcissistic abuse recovery from a clinical standpoint, dealing with the subtle nuances of depression, anxiety, complex PTSD, PTSD, panic disorder, needs to work with a therapist. That's at least a master's trained clinician, if not a doctorate trained clinician, who has a license for the state that they practice in, who is trained in understanding relational trauma. So hopefully that person has an understanding of personality disorders, trauma bond, relational trauma, and has some interventions at the ready to help their clients, such as EMDR, that's eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing, which is an evidence-based trauma-informed modality to help people heal through PTSD and also complex PTSD. There are many expressive arts modalities that are very beneficial. Mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy is also a modality that you can weave into healing and recovery, but these are all very nuanced interventions that need to be developed and implemented with a strengths-focused, trauma-informed clinician. And if somebody you're working with is not a clinician, is not licensed to practice these particular interventions, and claims to be able to do this with you over the phone or on Skype, that's pretty sketchy and frankly unethical. And I have a lot of respect for really ethical life coaches. I know a handful of them that are awesome. And in fact, I've interviewed them on my podcast, but you have to buyer beware. I have seen some life coaches purporting to be able to, first of all, practice EMDR when they're not clinicians and to do it on Skype. That's so unethical. So please be careful with whom you work with, because they need to be trained in knowing what the heck they're doing. They also, if they are a survivor of narcissistic abuse, they need to have done their own work so it's not infiltrating the client relationship. So I'll get off my soapbox there, but I'm very protective of my clients and I want them to work with a trauma-informed, strengths-focused, competent, ethical clinician. Working with life coaches is wonderful if they happen to be the handful of life coaches that I trust, and I will certainly not hesitate to provide the names of those life coaches that are survivors, compassionate advocates, and very prolific writers who know their stuff. That can be absolutely essential and helpful for a survivor to hear someone else's story from the standpoint of a life coach. But the clinical work lies with a therapist or clinician. And often when I work with my clients, I want them initially to tell their story. It's very important for the client to narrate their story of abuse, to get it out on paper or verbally, and to be able to release the pain of the experience so that they can acquire a sense of mastery over the circumstances. It also validates the reality of their experience, and it lessens the cognitive dissonance I was just talking about, which enables the survivor's mind to become less preoccupied with the intrusive recollections of abuse. And most of the clients I deal with who have had narcissistic abuse on some level have an element of PTSD or complex PTSD. So having their story narrated is important for empowerment and validation of the experience. And some people write it out in a journal, others type it out. It's important to have that validation and in a safe holding environment and having it witnessed and heard. The power of no contact is vital in the instance where it's a situation where the individual doesn't share children or a business with the person. So in those circumstances, and Kim talks about this on her podcast, but extreme limited contact is the way to go in those circumstances. And she is a wealth of information where that's concerned. But in circumstances where you absolutely can cut off contact and there are no children and no business affiliations, go absolutely no contact with an abuser. People who have NPD have very limited capacity for change. And I'm going to double back to those descriptions when I go through sort of this outline of interventions, because a lot of survivors wonder that if they just stick it out, they just give their abuser a chance to change, that things could be okay and they could go back to that infatuation idealization stage. And the answer to that is it really depends on how severe the narcissist is, because we know that narcissism exists on a spectrum. An individual can have narcissistic traits. An individual could have NPD, narcissistic personality disorder. They could be an extreme narcissist or a malignant narcissist or even a psychopath. But somebody who fits squarely on the diagnosis of NPD is pretty rigidly fixed and fused to who they are. And most definitely a malignant narcissist and psychopath. There's extremely limited opportunity for change. And if that change happens, it's minuscule and it is not maintained for long periods of time. Because what we're talking about is the basic psychological innards that a person possesses and how they're hardwired. And people with NPD are usually survivors of trauma themselves, but unfortunately, they didn't have a safe caregiver that they could attach to and develop a healthy inner psyche. So as a result, there's these Swiss cheese holes or chunks in their psyche that render them empty, and they have to have narcissistic supply from outside sources. The garden variety NPD person likes supply of all kinds, ego fuel. It could be appreciation, adulation, praise, whatever. But the more malignant the narcissist, the more they prefer extracting ego fuel that causes harm. So if they can hurt somebody by gaslighting them, projecting, blame shifting, silent treating, they will do that so that they can get a reaction out of their loved one that elicits pain and suffering. And it's cruel and it's sadistic and it's nearly psychopathic. So thus the power of no contact. In the circumstances where the abuser is extremely narcissistic, it's vital to make that clean break from the damaging relationship. That's essential for healing. It enables the survivor to go within, to heal, to reclaim clarity and move through recovery. So no contact means no phone calls, no texts, no emails, no Facebook stalking, no Instagram stalking, no contact, period. And the survivor is creating a healthy boundary to end the abuse by ceasing contact with his or her abuser. Now, the abuser could be male or female. We often talk a lot about males as being NPD because that seems to be more commonly reported, and women tend to show up more in therapy. But I can tell you that there are a lot of female NPD out there. And there's a lot of crossover with personality disorders in the cluster B category. I see a lot of crossover in the description of the abuser that my clients talk about. A lot of blending of borderline traits and narcissistic traits and antisocial traits. So it's pretty much a toxic soup. So during no contact, as I said, it's vital, and I cannot stress enough how important this step is. It is only when this step occurs that survivors can move on to the next stage. And it's like quitting a bad drug in some ways, cold turkey, even though it's not like an addiction. It's like you're letting go of the need to have that connection that you're seeking that was at the beginning of the relationship, the idealization, infatuation stage. It's really hard, and survivors need a lot of support during this time as they, so to speak, detox and go through sort of a withdrawal from the narcissistic abuse. Again, it's not the survivor's fault that they were abused. It's not their fault that they love their abuser. They're capable of love, and at the beginning, it seemed that there were compelling reasons that the abuser would have some sort of personality characteristics that could maintain a relationship. But unfortunately, we find that oftentimes this is just a facade to hook a survivor. So next steps are also releasing the grief. Clients need to get in touch with sadness and anger. They need a period of really, it's complicated grief. This is even worse than losing someone to death because the person's still walking around on the planet and has consciously chosen to reject the survivor. So it's really important for the client to be able to have a place to own and express and release their grief and all of the aspects of grief, sadness, anger, shock, disbelief, and eventually acceptance, thankfully. And in time, that trauma bond lessens as the survivor reincorporates and integrates back into the here and now and the future. And that also involves extreme self-care. And that means psychotherapy, life coaching with a competent life coach, competent therapist, exercise, good nutrition, good sleep, increased social supports. Each survivor needs to heal at his or her own pace, and that looks different for each individual. But I can tell you the healing journey is a long one, and the survivor needs to be very patient with themselves. For folks that really don't know what narcissistic abuse is until they've experienced it, sometimes that healing journey takes a little bit longer, but there's no deadline or timeline for how long it's going to take. You just have to be very patient with yourself. Self-care is not selfish, but it's an act of self-preservation and learning to turn nurturing energy toward oneself. So that's really important. I mentioned psychoeducation, understanding what happened and learning about the narcissistic abuse and recovery, terminology and the forms of emotional abuse sustained lessens cognitive dissonance. It helps break the trauma bond and enables the survivor to connect with the emotions of anger and release that anger in a healthy way moving forward through recovery. Again, it's not the survivor's fault. The survivor is not to blame. And understanding narcissistic abuse occurs in layers, much like peeling the layers of an onion. So sometimes a survivor might need to revisit all of this information many times before it really sinks in, because truly they are traumatized and so much of their experience is held in their body, just like Bessel van der Kolk talks about, and they may be experiencing muscle tension, insomnia, stomach aches, fight or flight or freeze responses, and it's hard to put into words their experience because the trauma is held in the part of the brain that's nonverbal. And that's one reason why EMDR is so helpful, because it's a trauma-informed modality, as is expressive arts, and it helps get out the trauma and reprocess it in such a way that the traumatic memories are stored in the appropriate place in the brain and that the verbal part of the brain can go back online and articulate and narrate the story of what they've been through. And sometimes EMDR needs to happen before a narration of the story can take place, simply because the survivor is so frozen in their shock and disbelief. The good news is that healing is absolutely probable. As long as the client is motivated to get the help, they will heal. And they will move on to love again in a healthy relationship. Part of the healing process is also, too, reclaiming the client's confidence in their own power. And oftentimes, survivors feel very depleted and need a period of time to reclaim their lost confidence and energy. They might have been very confident before they met the narcissist, and so now they need to reclaim their self-worth. Some survivors also feel triggered from past hurts. And so if there's any family of origin work or loss, grief issues that happened in their childhood, some of that will come out and needs to be healed and reprocessed as well. So moving forward, though, psychotherapy also involves empowering the client to reclaim healthy boundaries and increase self-awareness and discernment of healthy relationships in order to move forward with healing, because the abuser has really pushed through the boundaries of the survivor. It's very insidious. It's like the boiled frog analogy, where a frog is in warm, tepid water, and that water is gradually turned up little by little. Over time, the water's boiling and the frog is jolted to attention that they're about to boil. That's the nature of narcissistic abuse. It's so subtle and gradual, the boundary violations and the abuse, that the individual acclimates to it before they realize their boundaries are being violated. It's really sadistic and just incredibly destructive. But all survivors who want to heal do heal, and they're not broken. And some of the silver linings of healing are developing a sense of self-awareness and life wisdom that has been gifted to them, reassembling a newer and better version of themselves that is more astute and aware. Nobody enters life thinking they're going to encounter a pathologically abusive person in love, work, or family. But I think we can do a better job as a society by training children in the schools about what healthy relationships are and what they aren't. What is a toxic relationship? What's a healthy relationship? And I see this in some public schools with the anti-bullying campaigns that are going on, because you know what? Those bullies out there in the playground, if they don't get help, they go on to become narcissists. So the fact that there is a no-tolerance policy for bullying going on in at least the schools that I see, local to where I work and live, is heartwarming, because to me that means that the community is taking it seriously to educate our future generations about emotional health and wellness. And that's what creates peace on the planet. So it starts with communities, it starts with schools, it starts in the home, and it starts with education. Because imagine how many people would be able to pick out a narcissist or a toxic business partner, romantic partner, friend, and figure out who they are if they had that education beforehand. Think about that. So in any case, an excellent therapist or helping professional will work with the client to recognize the survivor's strengths and areas of growth, teach how to set healthy boundaries, provide accountability to enhance wellness, teach how to protect oneself from involvement with toxic people, and develop important present and future goals for wellness. The therapist's stance is always one of unconditional positive regard, creating a safe environment that holds complete trust in the client who has the ability to heal. And I'm fortunate enough to work with many, many clients who are incredibly brilliant, very emotionally intelligent, and I'm so honored to be able to witness their healing and moving forward from a place of surviving to thriving. We also do a lot of work with resolving depression, resolving anxiety, and PTSD, complex PTSD, as I mentioned before, EMDR. We work on ongoing coping skills, which can include incorporating deep breathing and yoga, creative visualization, connecting with spiritual community, addressing the specifics of self-care as relates to good nutrition, exercise, and sleep, journaling exercises, etc. So I could go on and on and on. I'm actually really excited as I'm reviewing my first edition of my book. There's so much more that I can expand upon and that I am expanding upon for the second edition, and that will be out at some point in the future, hopefully sooner than later. I've been really busy and fortunate to have a full practice, and also with writing and podcasting and raising my kids. So I'm a busy woman, but that second edition hopefully will be out sooner than later for survivors out there. And I am so glad to be able to share this time with you. Thank you so much for listening. And please come back to the Savvy Shrink podcast. Take care. Thank you again for listening to the Savvy Shrink. For more information about this podcast, go to thesavvyshrink.com. Or visit my website at AndreaSchneiderLCSW.com. This is your host, Andrea Schneider. Until next time.